Seems rather strange to have ignored that.
Well, I mean, it's like a lot of things that has happened in this country. They, to us who are familiar with what's going on, the government operates in mysterious ways with their own agenda, and I can think of no reason at all why the government shouldn't sign up to a number of the additional protocols which have come into existence in more recent years, of which that is happens to be one. And again, it's a sign of a lack of democracy in this country that we don't have. We've had few means of addressing this, and few means of ensuring that our government do sign up to that. It would seem to be a perfectly reasonable article to have in within the European Convention, or at least ratified by the UK government. And of course, the feminists having demanded equality of treatment, they could hardly argue against it, although they may find some excuse to do that. But it really is something that the UK government should be signed up to.
So that's Article 8, respect for the family?
Yes, respect for family and private life. Well, it ought to. it's Article 8 is divided into two parts, 8.1 and 8.2, I believe. And it guarantees respect for family life, and that there should be no interference by an authority, which includes things like local authorities and the social services, what's now called CAFCAS, and the courts themselves, of course. Authorities include the courts themselves, and no interference by an authority in a person's private and family life. That is not required, and there are some riders to this that accept so far as public morals and national security and various other things. Most of the many of the articles in the European Convention have riders on them concerning national security and various other things, including children's interests, I'm afraid. But yes, I mean, it is potentially important to us. But there was a case at the beginning of 2000, which was very significant in how the judge will behave when they have these the European Convention articles available. Now, the Human Rights Act 98 didn't come into force until towards the end of 2000, I think it was. But there was a case heard early in 2000 in which they did consider the European Convention, and in Article 8 in particular, in fact. And they were doing that because the judge at that point in time knew that any case occurring just before the Act came into force could be immediately appealed after the Act came into force. So they were beforehand, they were bearing it in mind. Anyway, this case involved a man and a woman who had been married, I think, in the south of England. The woman played a cello and wanted to take a job in New York playing the cello. And she wanted to take her daughter with her. And the man had applied to the court saying that if she was allowed to take the daughter with her to New York, he would obviously be cut off from his daughter, perhaps, you know, seeing her very infrequently, if maybe never again. And he claimed that that would be a violation of his right under Article 8 for family life. But the judges said, yes, he does have a right. He does have rights under Article 8 for his family life, and so does she. And further, she has rights for her private life, including the right to take a job wherever she wished. And so the judges found, because of that, they found in her favour. They essentially had to balance her rights under Article 8 for her private life, i.e. taking a job wherever she felt like it, with his rights in respect for family life. But they were, in the end, having to balance her right to take a job where she wanted to, with whether he ever saw his daughter again. And, of course, as usual, they found in favour of the woman. I can't imagine that situation applying the other way around. If the man wanted to take his daughter overseas, I'm sure that the woman's rights for the family life would have been respected. So I'm afraid we've got a very serious situation in this country with regard to how our judges behave and the sort of intellect that these judges have. They really ought to be brought under control by our MPs. As I said earlier, we do have a constitutional problem in this country about control of the MPs, and control of judges by our MPs.
So essentially, that's the bottom line. We need to get the MPs to pass something, in effect, to make the judges listen.
We do, yeah, that controls the behaviour of the judges and removes their discretion. I mean, effectively, for the last 50 years, judges have been making up the law themselves, and the outcome of separation and divorce is hardly related to the written law at all in all the substantive matters. I mean, the substantive matters being the children, outcome regarding the children, outcome regarding capital money and future income in the form of maintenance. And the judges have been making up the laws as they go along without any regard for what the laws that Parliament passed. They've also done it without any public consultation of any significant sort, and even without informing the public of what they've done. And that's why many men are so shocked at their treatment at separation and divorce. But the consultation exercise that we've got going on in this country, I mean, the Cheltenham Group made a submission at the recent consultation with the Dodd-Lanchester Chancellor's Department called Making Contact Work, and we pointed out all these issues. The Lord Chancellor's Department, in making policies, just bring along the sort of people who they want to hear the views of. You know, they ask the sort of questions they want to ask of those people who they think will give them the answers they would prefer to hear. And the two people who made up a lot of the policy in the Making Contact Work consultation exercise were called Doctors Sturge and Glazer. And these two women are psychiatrists who are promoting the children's best interests. Now, they're almost certainly feminists. It's in the interests of women that the children's best interests policy is actively promoted and encouraged and firmed up on in the law, because they know perfectly well that in a regime in which women automatically get custody, or usually get custody, that will leave men with few rights, because the children's interests will come before the father's interests. But, you know, so there's a consultation exercise by the Lord Chancellor's Department in setting policy to do, in this case, with Making Contact Work, in which two psychiatrists are brought along to give their opinions. In fact, it was their opinions that prevailed, because it was only about a week or two ago that the copy of the proposal from the Children Act Subcommittee, that was the subcommittee that within the Lord Chancellor's Department that was doing this, put down their recommendations to the Lord Chancellor, and that included accepting the recommendations of Sturgeon and Glazer. So we have two psychiatrists setting policy in this very important area, this crucial area of family law. Now, you know, psychiatrists are people who are used to treating mental illness. It raises the question as to why two people who are trained, educated, and equipped to treat mental illness are setting policy with regard to parents' contact with children after separation and divorce. That's the sort of regime we've got going on in the UK at the present time. And that's got to be changed, of course.
Surely there are other qualified people who could give a different view?
Well, of the people who made submissions, of which the Cheltenham Group was one, and various other groups like Families Need Fathers were another prominent group, and the Equal Parenting Council, and so prominent members of Families Need Fathers and Equal Parenting Council like Tony Coe were actually mentioned in the proposals and the final recommendations. But they were overwhelmed, and some significant points came across there, but they were overwhelmed by the number of submissions from the various women's groups that took place, and also from judges' views were represented there. And of course, that's another issue that we have in this country, that you know, judges are influential in setting policy in these matters. Well, where you have the same people making policy, effectively making laws, and applying those laws, well, we have a type of dictatorship there. And it was interesting that it was towards the end of 2001, there was a conference of judges took place in Bath. In fact, I think some of the groups had a demonstration outside of that conference at some point. But it's interesting that judges and lawyers from all over the world, well, mainly from the Western world, were asked to come along and give their views on how matrimonial and family law should be developed. Well, it's interesting that, you know, there were few people from the public there making their voices heard. If we have a situation in which judges make policy and effectively make laws, and the same people are implementing those laws as well as judges, well, we've got a type of dictatorship there. And, you know, the people of the United Kingdom are just not being heard. And it's because of that because we can see that taking place, that I personally believe that you know, it's time people, through their MPs in Parliament, reassert their authority over these judges. If we look at the States, there's a group in the States called We the People. That's the title of the group. And if you go on the UKMM website, there's a link on the overseas section to the We the People website. It's worth looking at that, because they point out that in the States also, it's often judges who make up the law and so on. And again, they're the ones that apply the law. So we've got a type of dictatorship here. And as they say, you know, from their name, it's we the people who should now start deciding how these things should be done. We the people should decide what laws we want, and not some judges, and certainly not two psychiatrists, as we see in the recent exercise.
Barry Wall of the UK Men's Movement and the Cheltenham Group, thank you very much.